This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Well, hello everyone, and welcome to another edition of Letters from Kayfabe. I'm here with that chap called Alan. How are you doing, Alan?
I'm doing great, Parv. How's our sack going at the moment?
Well, it's going all right. I mean, we've tried to formalise it a bit more. A couple of weeks ago, we were struggling to find all the different letters that we've had, because people kind of send them to us piecemeal, don't they, Alan?
So it's keeping track of them, really.
I've tried to centralise them on Twitter, see how long that lasts. So if you can find where I've said on Twitter... what exactly could they search for? Let's have a look.
Just search for Letters from Kayfabe in the search in Twitter and you'll find the actual tweet. It'll be one day recording this, middle of November. So have a look and you can ask questions there.
I said I'm looking to get the sack in order. So just reply to that and we'll definitely catch your question because, there are lots of them. I mean, we try to cover as many as we can. But we only have so much time every week. So without further ado, shall we get to the sack?
Yeah, let's go and take a delve into the sack.
We'll be back with the mailbag. Oh, and no doubt the mailbag has just arrived.
Well, if a postman delivered like that in England, I'd fire him immediately.
So the first one is, hey, Alan and Parv, love the show, but I don't have Twitter. I was hoping you could look at the random reappearance of Jose Estrada Sr. in the late 80s as a conquistador. I think he wrestled as himself a few times. And that's from Greg DeFore, who's from 411mania.com. So, Parv, Jose Estrada Sr., what do we know about him? What do you know about him?
Well, I know a fair old bit about him. First of all, I've been taking a time. I do another show here on... the Place to Be Nation called Titans of Wrestling, as you know. And on there, I've been taken to task for my awful pronunciation of Spanish Puerto Rican wrestlers time and time again. So I've learned that it's Jose. You have to say it in that manner. Jose Estrada. And basically, the rule is if they speak Spanish, you say it like that. And if they speak Portuguese... you say it more like Jose Mourinho. So that's one thing on the pronunciation, and I'm sure people will still complain about my pronunciation. And basically, in the late 70s, Vince Sr. had a kind of, I guess, a Puerto Rican job squad led by Johnny Rods, who was the locker room leader. Jose Estrada was a big member of that crew. And then a bunch of guys who were called Rivera in various different ways. Victor Rivera. There was one called Mac Rivera, who later became another Jose Luis Rivera. I want to say there was a Johnny Rivera as well. there was various different ones. And basically their job was to have those 10-minute matches on MSG and Philly cards to fill up the time, as we talked about a few weeks ago. Do you remember when we talked about that kind of layer of JTTS who have long house show matches?
Yeah, the ones that they're the really tough house show matches to get through as well, I feel, because there's really not much going on. I mean, the matches are okay, but there's not much riding on them, so they're kind of hard for me to be engaged with. But yeah, they were the kind of guys who did that in the late 70s. But talking of Jose Estrada himself, senior, He was getting destroyed a lot on TV, wasn't he? And I mean, the one thing that stood out to me, do you remember there was a boxing match he had against Boxing Bob Orton? It was Bob Orton's gimmick. And he lost a TKO loss. And that was really the last we saw of him as a Jose Estrada, because after that, he along with Moondog Rex, who'd, funnily enough, been kicked out of Demolition, would then become the Shadows, if you remember them, the hooded team who were decked out in black, Parv.
Yes, The Shadows, who are actually a knockoff team themselves, of a team known as the Demons, who I think again was maybe Estrada with Baron Cicluna earlier on. So he'd been in part of a few of these teams. I should mention as well that being Puerto Rican, he was part of a fairly famous team over there in Puerto Rico, working for Carlos Colón, known as the Super Medicos. Have you heard of them, Alan?
Yeah, I've heard of them. I mean, with Puerto Rico, especially the 80s stuff, the footage is out there. There's plenty of stuff on YouTube, and there's some great action. I mean, a lot of bloody brawls, people know, but, you know, there is some great work as well from what I've seen anyway. I mean, you've probably had a deeper delve into the 80s Puerto Rico scene.
Yeah, I mean, there's some good bloody brawls and things. It's kind of wild there, you know, the fans are wild, and they have matches in those kind of big stadiums, and there's no railings and things, so it's kind of a wild environment. But yeah, the Super Medicos in Puerto Rico were Estrada and Johnny Rods, I think, was the other one. So they shuttled back and forth between, I think Estrada kind of made regular little stops back in Puerto Rico all throughout the time that he was a jobber in New York. So anyway, let's get back up to the mid-80s. So he loses this boxing match and becomes a conquistador. And the other conquistador is the chap I just mentioned, Mac Rivera, a.k.a. Jose Luis Rivera. But you just mentioned a Moondog. Now, tell me where the Moondog is getting involved, Alan.
Okay, well, before the conquistadors, where he was conquistador Dos, and Jose Luis Rivera was conquistador Uno, before that, Jose along with Moondog Rex with the Shadows. So that's what happened with Jose. Then he went into the conquistadors with Rivera, and they were billed from somewhere in Latin America. So he actually himself debuted in 87, losing to Coco Ware, simply as Jose Estrada, will debut as such. And he worked singles until November. He worked house show matches against Dingo Warrior, who later became Ultimate Warrior, Lanny Poffo, Brady Boone, who we've discussed in previous episode, Sam Houston, and even Chavo Guerrero Sr. Had some matches with Jose Estrada, which was quite interesting to see. But his Conquistador's debut, that was against Strikeforce on Superstars in November 87. And the team themselves, if you've seen them, Pal, they were gold, all decked in gold. Imagine a full gold dust outfit with a mask as well, was the best way to describe them, I'd say.
Yeah, and I'm interested to see that Chavo wrestled a few matches. He's a great wrestler, Chavo Guerrero. So any memories of the Conquistadors on it?
Well, the main memory for me at the time was the Survivor Series 88 match. I loved that match. It went probably about 40, 45 minutes, if you remember. There was 10 tag teams, five on each side. So there's 20 men around the ring. And it was the match with the infamous double turn with the Barbarian and Warlord. They turned the Powers of Pain and Demolition turned as well, if you remember that match. They're in at the end, the Conquistadors, in that match as well, which was quite interesting. They managed to get there without really beating anyone themselves, because they were only ever really pushed as a real low-level team. They traded some wins now and again, but more often than not, they were on the losing side. But there was one match that stood out to me. Rivera, who wasn't Jose Estrada, he was the other Conquistador. He had a shot against Macho Man Savage on a taping in July 88 when Savage was the champion, and we had our guy was ringside for support just in case anything went wrong, and Savage would counter that by having Hulk Hogan. So we had the Conquistadors on one side, so to speak, and we had Hogan and Savage on the other. Have you seen that match, Parv?
No, I haven't seen that one. Ed, have you?
Yeah, I've seen it a while ago. I've not watched it for the purposes of this. And sadly, it wasn't meant to be. I mean, Jose Estrada, not being the corner man for the future world champion, because I don't think we would see one of the Conquistadors as the world champion then leading the WWF into the late 80s. It just wasn't meant to be. They actually beat, in July of 88, Sam Houston and Terry Taylor in a dark match, but we've actually got footage of that match, and it was quite interesting because that match was the heel turn of Terry Taylor, wasn't it, Parv?
I did watch this one. That's quite funny, actually, because Taylor, but what happens is, but Sam Houston takes the fall, and Taylor's really angry and then starts kicking the shit out of Sam Houston, saying, you know, I've just debuted, how dare you tag me up with this job guy, which I thought was quite funny, because I always saw Sam Houston as being above that level. So
Yeah, and then they did actually beat the Rockers as well. They were working with them around the horn in August and September of 88, but they beat them in one of the shows, which was Turn Up for the Books there. I don't know if that was to tell Marty and Sean to calm down or something around that time, but that was an interesting result to see nevertheless. They lasted until my birthday, my 7th birthday, funnily enough, which was 19th of March 89, where they lost to the Young Stallions. And by that point, Estrada, who had been working under his real name, began losing to the likes of Horner, Roma and Sam Houston. So that was really the Conquistadors. It didn't do much noteworthy. I mean, the gimmick came back as a kind of tongue-in-cheek one years later with Edge and Christian. I don't know if you remember that around the turn of the century.
Yeah, I seem to remember they're one of those teams who are kind of brought up on the old school Raws and things, aren't they? The Conquistadors. I seem to remember there's one deal with the original Conquistadors where they're kind of in their masks and their gold outfits, having an ice cream. That's one. I mean, it's like literally a quick ad, you know, like a 20-second clip. You can probably find it on YouTube. That's one of the things, and they're speaking Spanish, having an ice cream. Estrada, for his kind of, he carried on working as Conquistador Dos into 1990, and he has several matches, losing efforts, of course, to Dusty Road, Coco Ware, Tugboat. So one of the interesting things for me is that when he worked as the Conquistador in a singles, he tended to job very quickly. When he worked as Jose Estrada, he may sometimes get kind of longer matches.
It's easier to wrestle not in that gold suit and mask, maybe, Parv. You know, it's he's taking, you know, a hit by doing that. So when he's out of that, yeah, he could probably wrestle as good as most other people.
I watched a 13-minute match earlier from 1989 against Tim Horner from an MSG show. And it was, it was pretty brutal. It took a long... That 13 minutes felt like half an hour, you know. Estrada was basically a specialist at just having that match, having that undercard match on the house show. And I'm guessing they were getting kind of double the money for him here, that he was basically portraying himself some nights. And he was one of the Conquistadors another night. And I guess that there must have been occasions where he worked double duty as himself and as one of the Conquistadors. So.
Oh yeah, there were some no-shows on the card. Definitely that would have been probably what he was meant to do. But after the run, then he kind of... career faded out. He did some shots in Puerto Rico and then he wrestled in Wing in 92 and 93, and that was really the end of him. But his son wrestled in the WWF, didn't he?
Yeah, last thing I'll say about Jose Estrada, and this is going to sound very unusual to some listeners, is that, you know, watching him in the early 80s, he sometimes reminds me of Bad News Brown. And it's not just because he's bald and has a beard, so like he visually looks quite a lot like him. But he has kind of like some of the same mannerisms and things. And it did make me think whether he's a kind of strange influence on the later Bad News Brown there. So there we go.
maybe Bad News was checking out the tapes at the time while I was up in Calgary. Shall we move on to the next question then, Parv?
Yeah, I think that's enough on Estrada.
Okay, well, next one is, dear Parv and Alan, one of my brother's favourite wrestlers was Bastian Booger. Where did he come from and why didn't he last? Wasn't he unbeatable with his hump so nobody could pin him? Was that a real or fake hump? And that's from Grimace in Toronto, Ontario, Canada. So... firstly, he wasn't the guy with a hump. He didn't have a hump per se, did he, Parv?
No. I mean, I was reading this. I was reading around this, and it's claimed that the gear that he wore made him look more like he had a hump, but I didn't really notice that in the... Do you think he looks humpback, Alan?
I don't know if he looks humpback, because Mike Shaw actually came out later on and said the gimmick was supposed to be some kind of sewer creature. His words. So Vince, you know, imagine Vince. This is pure Vince poop, shit, burp humour. And I'm convinced that to Vince that a video of a guy picking his nose would be pure comedy gold. So a guy like Booger would be straight up Vince's alley for Vince's stupid humour. So his gimmick was he was a fat slob with bad hygiene. His music as well, Parv, was brilliant. It was farts and belches and kind of this sinister music. But yeah, this sewer creature. But just before then, Parv, you were looking at what he was doing in the WWF, weren't you?
Yeah, well, this is very unusual because it's not actually the debut. It's not actually the gimmick that he came in with. He came in as a guy called Friar Ferguson, who basically is an evil monk. You can watch this match on YouTube. It's against Chris Duffy. It's on the 12th ever edition of Monday Night Raw. And he looks quite a lot like the version of Friar Tuck that you see in Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, which I guess would have been around that time, wouldn't it?
Yeah. In the 90s. Well, maybe that was the reason and the tie-in for the gimmick. But it got a little bit of heat, didn't it, with the Catholic Church? Or perceived heat, they were worried that it might get heat. So the gimmick was canned.
I just want to pause on this Friar Ferguson deal for a second, because if you watch that match, he takes Chris Duffy's head, puts it up his
robe.
His friar's robe. What do you call it? A monk's habit? Is that right? Habit? Yeah.
That sounds about right.
So he puts the jobber's head up his habit, makes a kind of silly face, and like he's pouring water in his face. Is that holy water, I guess? I was thinking, what is this in aid of? Like, you've got Macho Man burying it on commentary, just like paying it no attention at all. It's just horrible, don't you think?
Yeah, no, it's not great at all, that gimmick, and they quickly dropped that one, which it wouldn't have worked to me anyway. I had no value in it. But his debut as Bastian Booger was interesting, wasn't it, Parv? Because he actually lost on his debut to Virgil. I mean, you lose your debut match to Virgil. My God. And that was on Superstars in May 1993. I mean, there's nothing worse than your debut match losing to Virgil, is there?
So, well, I mean, basically, he comes back a month later, re-debuting in a different gimmick. He's given 2 minutes on Superstars against Virgil. And again, there's even a moment where Vince turns to Savage and says, well, what do you make of Bastian Booger? And Savage just completely blows him off and says, oh, you know, he's talking about whatever angle's going on at the time. Doesn't give a shit at all. And Virgil picks up a rare win for him in 1993. So, you know, if you're debuting in a losing effort to Virgil, not a lot is happening for you from the get-go. And I read somewhere that this was actually a punishment from Vince. Did you read this?
No, I didn't come across that. That's interesting.
That basically, Vince wanted to punish him for being overweight. So he gave him the Bastian Booger gimmick, which was this filthy slob, as you said, made him wore ill-fitting tights to accentuate his overweightness. And basically, this is where the humpback business comes in, because I'll just read it here. This is actually on his Wikipedia page, so, you know, I haven't gone too deep with this research here, but it says, allegedly as a punishment for his weight, he was given the name Bastian Booger, with the gimmick of an unkempt, slovenly and gluttonous man who wrestled in a dingy, too small, grey or beige singlets tailored to give him the appearance of a hunchback. Shaw's debut as a Booger saw him lose to Virgil. So, I mean, there we go.
Well, I'll take that with a pinch of salt, because if you think about it, he was overweight when they hired him. They'd only had him a few months. So how could they punish him for being overweight when you think about it? So I'm not too sure about that one.
Also, when you hire in like Norman the Lunatic, what do you expect?
Yeah, I mean, he got saddled with some bad gimmicks at the end, didn't he, there? He was Norman the Lunatic, Truck and Norm, Friar Ferguson, and then Bastian Booger. The match that struck for me, Parv, was he had a dark match on a Raw in 1993 in the Manhattan Center against Backlund, and that match went to a draw. So imagine watching a dark match on Raw and it was Booger Backlund and it goes to a draw. My God.
I wonder what Backlund did with him. I mean,
yeah.
I can't.
It wouldn't have been pretty.
Could he do the row? You know, the row arm ringers on Bastion Booger?
Oh, God, I don't know. I mean, he did have 27 TV appearances in 93, and as well as a Royal Rumble appearance. Survivor Series appearance. And he did have some more appearances in 94, four TV appearances. But there was some interesting takes that I've seen looking at his career. Did you know that he was supposed to be in the Royal Rumble in 94, Parv?
Well, it would make sense, I think. I mean, why wasn't he?
It was shown picking his Royal Rumble number on a live WWF Mania before the show, and he revealed 28, his number. And that was a direct violation of the rules, even though the rules have never been documented or enforced before. So he was forced to redraw his number, which we didn't find out what he was. But he didn't actually appear during the match, because when the buzzer came out, no one came out. They moved on to the next guy. And Booger was apparently said to have food poisoning, which went along with the fat slob gimmick. So that was the reason why he missed his Royal Rumble spot in 1994. But I watched a match as well, Parv, against Crush. Around this time, and oh my God, this is the type of match you would book if you hated life. It was not good whatsoever. I mean, the commentators on the actual match put over how much Bastion Booger smells. He stunk more than Friar Ferguson, just in a whole different way, I think. And Heenan claims that Booger is Hillary Clinton's half brother, which is quite funny given the time we're recording this the day before the election. And I don't know where that link came from, but I mean, the actual match itself, it's woeful. I mean, Booger's punches, they're really poor. They barely connect with Crush, and Crush is unable to do anything with him at all. Crush tries to do a back body drop on him, and it ends up looking pathetic, to be totally honest. Like, something you would, if you went to a training school on the first or second day and you saw some guys doing it, it'd look like that. And Vince didn't even, you know, really try and cover up for it. I mean, that's how bad it was. But yeah, that match absolutely, you know, was horrid. And it was, you know, what summed up Bastion Booger, really. It didn't work well in this gimmick. I mean, he was a good worker, wasn't he, Parv? If you've seen any of his stuff from Stampede in the 80s, as was it Makai Singh? Singh, wasn't it? Yeah. I'm going to pronounce that wrong. Makai,
yeah. Something like that, yeah.
He was working there, and he was good, and he could move as well for a big man, even into the late 80s in the NWA WCW run as Norman Lunatic. But by this point, you know, he pretty much stunk, didn't he? I mean, have you got any kind of memories of Mr. Booger?
Well, I do. I remember absolutely hating him when I was a kid, because I didn't like slob gimmicks. Don't like it. You know, I hate to touch him. Myself, I mean, you wouldn't want to have your hands on him, would you? In any shape or form, even in the wrestling ring.
Yeah, it'd put you off working with him, I think.
I seem to remember. Doesn't he turn up on a Survivor Series? Isn't he part of one of the teams there?
He's knocking around eating chicken with the head shrinkers, I think, and someone else, or something like that in 93. I think. So just pull up his record from 93.
Yeah, here we go. Men on a Mission, and the Bushwhackers defeat Bam Bam Bigelow, Bastion Booger, and the Head Shrinkers.
Yeah.
I mean, that's got to be towards the low point of wrestling there.
Yeah, I think that match was probably a dud. From memory, it wasn't good. I think 93 and 94 had some horrible matches, and I think they're containing, like, the Bushwhackers in both, maybe. I'm not too sure. But they weren't great whatsoever. Oh. But yeah, Bastion Booger, not anyone that really did much, but he did have a trading card, part of the 1994 WWF set. So he did have a little bit of merchandise out there, which, you know, may have helped him monetary-wise. But no, he wasn't great at all.
Grimace's brother was a fan, so maybe he'd appreciate the card.
Yeah, but yeah, his music was rubbish. He wasn't any meaningful matches, and he was getting beat by Owen Hart. But he did beat Owen Hart in a match, to be fair.
I watched that one as well. I also watched him against Earthquake. Did you see that one? That was really interesting, because Earthquake seemed hugely over there in February of 94. I mean, the crowd were going crazy for him. But it did interest me that, obviously, like, Earthquake isn't that much bigger than Bastion Booger. And this is something I wanted to ask you about, Alan, because it's something I've never ever been able to get my head around, is when you get the fat man jobber. I mean, doesn't it bury the idea of a big man being big, you know? Like, so if you have somebody like Bastion Booger, you know, jobbing around low down on the card, doesn't it actually hurt guys like Earthquake or King Kong Bundy when he comes back? Or Do you know what I mean? Because they're the same.
No,
build.
I do know what you mean. They are the same build, and they push the half of the reason that they win is because of the size. But the other half is because they've got skill, or they're pushed and perceived as having skill compared to someone like Booger. So if you put him neck and neck with a equal jobber, he would beat that equal jobber because he's bigger. So someone around this time in 93, I mean, he was beating, he beat the 1-2-3 kid. So
PJ Walker, I can see.
Yeah, so the kind of, he's bigger, so he should beat the 1-2-3 kid. I don't know.
Jim Powers, he's dropping fours to Sparky Plug, though, so there's a cap on that. I mean, bloody hell.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, I see your point, though, overall, that, you know, as you're perceived as someone that's bigger, you should be beating smaller guys, or otherwise it devalues other bigger guys. So I see there's a point there, definitely, and I do agree with you, really.
Yeah, I just think it's strange. I mean, at least have him beating 1-2-3 Kid, you know, and I don't know. I mean,
and Virgil.
And Virgil, I mean, dropping fours to Virgil out of the gate. This just seems like another one of those, like, Vince is a sadist deals. He just, like, hates fat people and needs to have somebody on the card who he's burying for being fat at all times, seemingly.
Yeah, no, I think definitely one of Vince's weird ones there. So we'll move on to the next question then, Parv. So we've got, Dear Alan and Parv, loving the new Letters from Kayfabe show. I'm currently binge listening, 2 down, 2 to go. Which is a bit odd, 2 down, 2 to go. I think we've had this question quite a while, Parv. If you
well, I mean,
that.
Like I said before, the sack is full, and we're working through the back catalogue. It takes us, you know, we only get through 3 or 4 shows, so it might take a while.
Yeah, this was at the bottom of the sack we got this one from. So a topic of discussion that would interest me and hopefully interest you enough to research it and dedicate a segment to it involved Roddy Piper's heel run from his debut in 84 up to his absence in the summer of 86. He notoriously bragged about not doing jobs during this run. Are there any times he took an actual 3 count or submitted during this period? I doubt there were any submissions, but I feel that there would be a few pinfall losses. If so, could you detail those? If there truly weren't any, can you shed some light on more controversial moments when he was asked a job and refused? Keep up the good work, very enjoyable thus far. And that's from Joey Ode in South Amboy, New Jersey, and he sent that in on Facebook. So thank you very much for the message, Joe. So he did lose a few times, Parv. I mean, have you gone through the results yourself and had a look?
No, this was one that you took a lead on, Alan. So why don't you fill us in? Did he, in fact, drop a pinfall?
Yes, he did. He dropped a pinfall 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, at least 10 times. Interestingly enough, though, not many televised. I'll get to that. So the first one, though, was a pinfall loss to Jimmy Snuka in a Fijian strap match.
Right.
And that was in 1984 at the Nassau Coliseum, January. So that was the first one that he lost. And then after that, it was in 87, he lost to Adrian Adonis after guest referee Andre the Giant held Piper down while making the 3 count. So that was quite interesting. That was January the 30th, 87. So that must have been when Andre turned heel.
Yeah, Piper was face by this point.
And yeah, Piper turned face by this point. So that was quite an interesting result. So that one wasn't clean. The next one, he didn't suffer a pinfall loss till 1990. And that's when he got beat by Rick Rude after Rude hit him with the timekeeper's bell.
Right.
And then later on in the year in 1990, he lost to Intercontinental Champion Kurt Hennig, Mr. Perfect, after the Perfect Plex. And after the bout, Piper shook Perfect's hand. Which, again, is an interesting one. And then in 91, he lost quite a few times to Ric Flair, MSG and other places, all the time with the Flair winning with his feet on the ropes. And then, if you remember, he lost to Bret Hart at WrestleMania 8 as well.
Right.
So they were the pinfall losses in his WWF run. I mean, he had a few more in his career after this. I mean, he lost to Hogan at Super Bowl 7. He lost to Hall in July of 1997. He lost to Buff Bagwell in a boxing match. Buff Bagwell managed to pin Roddy Piper in a boxing match in 99, which is classic WCW there, because obviously in a boxing match you can't pin someone. He got beat again by Scott Hall at Super Bowl 9, and then finally back in the WWE he got beat by Mr. America, pinned Hulk Hogan. Hulk Hogan, Mr. America, pinned Piper in 2003. So they were all these kind of losses he had after 84. I mean, the only clean one technically in the WWF, Parv, was the one to Mr. Perfect, which is quite interesting.
Wow. On TV, that is.
No, it wasn't on TV. That was a house show. The only ones he had on TV were, say, the WrestleMania 8 one, and I think maybe the strap match, but I couldn't get the footage he had against Snuka. But the WrestleMania 8 one, I don't know if you listened, there was an interview recently by his son on the Friend of the Show 605 podcast, where Brian Last interviewed him, and he discussed with his father's kind of methodology behind that pin. So I don't know if you listened to that. So what he actually said was, it could have been a disputed finish still, because technically, even though he got pinned, what a referee should do is check the person whose the move's been applied on first. So he should still be checking Bret Hart, not Roddy Piper.
Interesting. So there's a get out of jail card if Piper wants to use it later on.
Yeah. Which was quite interesting. So we had that in there, like you said, in his back pocket. But they were his losses. And, I mean, it was important for someone like Piper to not lose too many times, I felt, to keep that aura about him that went well into the 90s that got him his fat contracts in WCW as well, I think.
Yeah, well, I mean, there is one more that I spotted here against Hogan. Did you mention that one?
Which one was that part of?
This is in 84, and it's... let's have a look. So he lost to Hogan by count out at the Boston Garden. So that obviously that doesn't count. But a few weeks before that, there was a match where it just says he was defeated. But obviously this was a house show, and we don't exactly know how that happened, because sometimes they don't have all of the information, you know.
Yeah.
But it's possible. I mean, Hogan was white hot in early 84. I can imagine that. You know, it wouldn't be out of the bounds of possibility for him doing a pinfall loss there. But really, if you go back to the original question, because he, the chap on Facebook said, you know, just in his heel run, like literally just in that 84 to 86 period.
Yeah.
Apart from that Snuka match and apart from the Hogan one, he's basically right, isn't he? He didn't really lose by count out that I can see.
No, you're right. He didn't. His losses were few and far between, like just the ones we discussed. I mean, he did ask on the question later on, Joe, about any controversial moments when he was asked to do the job. And the one I remember was the WrestleMania 2 one against Mr. T. You know, the boxing match.
Yeah.
He felt that, you know, he didn't want to lose clean. He felt he wanted to protect the business. He didn't want to look foolish. And he fought hard to and fro with Vince about the finish. But Piper did, in the end, lose the match. But he did so with a DQ rather than something clean. And I can see why he would want to do that, really. In this era still, with Mr. T, I mean, Piper would be the one that would be around still after this. Where would Mr. T? He was never going to be a full-time wrestler, was he?
Yeah, and I've even pulled up this loss in San Diego to Hulk Hogan, and I can see now the full results say it was by DQ. So he even didn't drop a pinfall to Hogan.
No, so it was the one we discussed was the Snuka one, wasn't it? That's the loss we can see during the heel run.
Yeah, which, I mean, for a heel in W, because obviously it was always such a babyface territory, wasn't it? For a heel, that's quite unusual. Because if you look at all of the other heels that come in, they really do, you know, a job around the horn when they're locked in feuds.
Yeah.
It's not unusual to see guys losing all around the place. And Piper seemingly just didn't do that, even in the house shows, which is remarkable. But I guess it worked for him because it made him a huge star. Wins and losses matter, eh, Alan?
Well, definitely. I mean, in this era, you know, completely. But now we're educated to see in the WWE that they don't as much. And for my being a long-time fan, that's to its detriment. But that's not really something we're going to cover here. So is there anything else you want to add about Piper or his career in general? Was he someone that you enjoyed?
Not especially. Like I said before, I much preferred him as a heel than I did as a babyface. But I think we've talked a lot about Roddy Piper on this show, Alan. We can, in the interest of time, I feel that we should go to JT Rosero at the event center.
Let's take you down to the event center.
Did Thank you, Parv. Thank you, Alan. Justin Rosario here with York Letters from Kayfabe Event Center. I want to take it back to 1991 this week. November 30th is the date, and it was a pretty interesting date in WWF history because we had four house shows. One at the Philadelphia Spectrum as a matinee, and a little bit north in London, Ontario, was our other matinee show. And then back at night, we had a show in Madison Square Garden, as well as the Hamilton, Ontario, and the Cops Coliseum. Four shows. Here's your cards. In Philadelphia, the Texas Tornado defeated the Berserker. The Nasty Boys defeated the Rockers. Virgil defeated Skinner. Tito Santana over Kato. Jim Duggan over the Barbarian. The Big Boss Man defeated IRS. Bret Hart defeated the Mountie. And, yes, in a Spectrum house show match at a matinee, Hulk Hogan defeats Ric Flair versus Reverse Decision when the Rockers helped make the save for Hogan against Flair and his executive consultant, Mr. Perfect. 10,318 saw that match, including a young Steve Corino in the Philadelphia Spectrum. We'll get back to Hogan and Flair in a moment. We head over to London, Ontario, across, like I said, up north. On that same matinee, the Warlord defeated Greg Valentine. Ted DiBiase defeated Chris Chavis. Chris Walker defeated Hercules. The Beverly Brothers defeated the Bushwhackers in the feud that never ends. Randy Savage knocked off Jake Roberts. Legion of Doom defeated the Natural Disasters by DQ. And The Undertaker defeated Davey Boy Smith. And this was an interesting match because it was for the WWF World title. So The Undertaker defending his title in between Survivor Series and when he would lose it less than a week later at Tuesday in Texas, a very rare defense for Taker against the British Bulldog. That night on MSG Network with Vince McMahon, Bobby Heenan, and Lord Alfred on commentary, Tito Santana defeated Kato, Kerry Von Erich over the Berserker, Virgil defeats Skinner, Hulk Hogan defeats Ric Flair again by reverse decision. Rocker's not involved this time. Jim Duggan beat the Barbarian, Bret Hart over the Mountie, IRS over the Big Boss Man, Nasty Boys over the Rockers. And again, a pretty memorable moment that happened on Primetime Wrestling where Sags pinned Jannetty after a small package because we had a little bit of a mix-up between the Rockers and Michaels ended up apologizing to his partner before Marty left him in the ring. Also, in Ontario that night, Warlord defeated Greg Valentine, Ted DiBiase over Chris Chavis, Beverly Brothers over the Bushwhackers, Randy Savage over Jake Roberts, Chris Walker over Hercules, and again, The Undertaker over Davey Boy Smith. And LOD defeats the Natural Disasters, this time by countout. So these Hulk Hogan Ric Flair match is pretty interesting. Of course, they did one loop, and if you believe many of the news reports out there from Dave Meltzer and others, of course, they claim that it was due to the sagging attendance during some of these shows, or at least as they'd run through the towns between Ric Flair and Hulk Hogan, as to why they decided not to do the match at WrestleMania, thinking it would not draw appropriately on pay-per-view. Now, there may be other reasons afoot, but the way WrestleMania 8 did shake out with Hulk Hogan having his final match against Sid Justice, Randy Savage fought Ric Flair for the world title. It's hard to really say we could have done better than that, but Hogan-Flair will always be that WWF match that could have been and that never really was. And WCW would cash in years later, so you have to wonder, what could WrestleMania 8 have really drawn Hulk Hogan versus Ric Flair? But we do at least have some matches on tape between them on these house shows. So check them out. I know at least the MSG one is on WWE Network and, of course, some other DVDs as well, that match between Hogan and Flair. So I am out. We'll go back to the lads, Parv and Allen, and they're going to talk all about the three-man unit of Demolition. I'll be back next week. Thanks.
Well, thank you very much for that, JT. Did you enjoy speaking to him last week, Alan?
I had an absolutely brilliant time speaking to JT. Bosom buddies now. We're having a bit of a bromance. And someone definitely that I enjoyed having on, and hopefully we're going to have him on for the whole show again in the future.
Brilliant. Right. Well, I think we've got time for one more, so let's go back to the sack.
Right. This one is Dear Alan and Parv. I want your opinion on Demolition's 1990 heel turn when Crush joined the team. Specifically, how the announcers sold the turns since there had been no hint of a turn before Crush appeared. And that's from Heard It on the X, who's sent that in from Twitter. So the heel turn in 1990, Parv, can you remember how this came about?
Let me think. How did this come about? I want to say that Mr. Fuji emerged back on the scene at some point.
That was a bit later on. That was in October of 1990. So what actually happened was right before WrestleMania 6, the Hart Foundation had challenged the winners of the Demolition Colossal Connection match. That was viewed as very much, you know, a face versus face program, since Warrior and Hogan had headlined WrestleMania 6. So it you know, was in the realms of possibility. But shortly after WrestleMania 6, The Rock is also threw the name into the mix, creating a kind of interesting three-way feud. So after that, it was just a couple of weeks after that, Demolition just really began acting heelish in the matches. They were insecure, really, about surviving three-way feud with the titles, so Crush suddenly appeared. And in Crush's first promo with the team, he mentioned they don't need any of these stinking people. That was basically the line, and voila, the heel turn was complete. To me, it could have worked a little bit better. They could have explained that Crush brainwashed them or came in and explained to them this, you know, where they were going, the fans didn't mean anything. But it was never kind of pushed like that. It was just kind of, we don't need these people. There's three of us now. And that's that. And this was really only one of a few examples of an active championship team or someone who had a belt to turn at the time as they had the actual title. The only real examples that I could see was Savage.
Yeah, I guess he turned while he was champ, yep.
And there was kind of a discussion that Pat Patterson turned, really, with the IC title, or he was more cheered.
Well, there's a bit of skullduggery with the Grand Wizard there. The Grand Wizard basically either sells his contract without telling him, or he starts managing someone else. Like, you think he starts managing Ken Patera or something. Patterson's like, hold on, what are you doing, Grand Wizard? And that is basically what triggers his face turn. So that's what happens there with Patterson. But I guess he does basically turn face just as he loses the IC strap there. So
they're the only real documented examples not documented ones that I could think of. The idea of the trio team was a mutual decision to phase out Axe. That was the idea, and for him to maintain more of a backstage role, because at the time I think he was 43, so he was pushing up in years. There was a popular rumor at the time that he was actually had a, you know, heart problem, a heart condition. I don't know if you've read that, Parv, and that was the reason for this. Kind of team.
I know his health was failing, Axe's, and that he was actually thinking about, like, what one of the things I know about Billy Eady is that he's always been interested in the office part of wrestling, and like he's wanted a book and things like that, and I believe there was talk of Eady being given the book. First of all, in WCW, and then maybe in USWA or one of these, maybe even what's that other one?
Global.
And I think he maybe even does end up going to one of these places to book in the office more. And that was one of the reasons why they brought in Crush, so that they could basically continue booking Demolition, because obviously they had Demolition booked for loads of dates in advance, and rather than cancel them all because Axe may be leaving, they decided to bring in a third guy who could basically replace him on all the shows, which is the kind of boring non-kayfabe answer.
Just to debunk though, the reason they talked about he had this heart condition, it was really an allergic reaction to shellfish while he was in Japan after WrestleMania 6, which would have been the matches or the show we discussed on a previous episode. Do you remember the Dome show from April of 1990, Parv? So maybe he was having some bad shellfish around that time outside the Tokyo Dome. And, you know, that was how one of the reasons why Crush had been recruited as a temporary replacement before Eady was medically cleared again, as well as the office role. But getting to Fuji, though, he didn't return until, you know, in the fall, until later, which I said was in October the 9th. So what actually happened was LOD were having a match with the Orient Express, and the Demolition just run in and did a five-man beatdown on LOD, and it was implied at the times that the Demolition had a working relationship with the Orient Express, so they officially named Fuji the manager the following week. So that was the reason how Fuji parlayed his way back in with Demolition.
Yeah, no, I mean, just going back a little bit, I did watch some of these early interviews where Crush joined the team, and Axe does seem to become like the kind of, just before Fuji comes back, he does kind of transition into a almost like manager role there, because often it would be Smash and Crush as the guys who are actually going to work the matches, and Axe on the outside, or Axe like leading the interviews or hiding under the ring sometimes. And I noticed they were mainly working this angle with Hart Foundation, weren't they? And did you watch any of these things where Bret Hart and Jim Neidhart really, really took exception to the fact that there was a third member of Demolition? And Bret Hart's line again and again during this was, "I don't understand three. I don't understand three. I, you know, tag team has got two, and you guys have got three." And Bret Hart really couldn't get his head around that. And I thought that, I just thought that made him seem really stupid. I mean, it was not that hard, Bret. I mean,
has he never seen Texas? Has he never seen Georgia? You know what I mean? He'd never seen the Freebirds. My God, Bret.
He hasn't. He hasn't. No. Has he?
So, you know, how do you feel they work differently as faces and heels? I don't think they changed the style too much. You know, they were a smash team, you know, punches, kicks, clubbing forearms, things like that. I don't think much apart from, you know, the odd, you know, pulling of the hair and, you know, the blind tags and things like that, distracting the referee. But I don't think there was much of a style change in the ring, was there?
Well, when this question came up, I thought, well, there's one man in the pro wrestling only universe who would be able to answer this question in much more detail than I ever could, having sat through many more Demolition matches than I ever would. The person I'm talking of is, of course, Matt D, who really loves Demolition. I should say, Alan, I don't like Demolition. I never have done. They're just not one of my... they just bored me. They did then, and they do now. Are you a fan of theirs, before I go into this?
Yeah, no, I was a fan of theirs. I'd seen Demolition, I would say, before Legion of Doom. You know, so a lot of people obviously seen it the other way around. So I never straight away felt them as a rip-off team or something that were trying to be someone else. So I never got that vibe, which put people off. And the music was cool as hell as well. And the look was kind of cool at the time. Looking back, it's a little bit S&M-ish. What kind of had with the masks and things, but yeah, I didn't mind them whatsoever.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't know. I guess even back then, I liked the suplex, Alan, and those guys were just, I knew if it was going to be them, you'd never get much more than a clubbing blow. Basically, they were such a punch and kick team, weren't they?
They were.
And I, you know, they never did any moves, and I guess little Parv was a moves guy, and yeah. So I just thought that their matches were always boring. Anyway, here's Matt D. He says, there's a big difference between heel demos without Crush and heel demos with Crush. And then he goes into pros and cons. You want to go into this?
Yeah, go for it.
The biggest thing Crush added was a layer of physicality. When Axe was still in the mix directing traffic, Crush was used well to add a layer of physical impressiveness and power moves that Smash couldn't really pull off. Axe and Smash were much more about consistent pressure and clubbering and grinding. But Crush came in and gave them an element of flash with the power moves. There was less focus when it was just Crush and Smash, however. So basically Crush, he could throw a suplex or a military press or a... You know, he did do a few more throws. It wasn't just pure punches all the time. And then he says, Axe directing traffic, either from the corner or the outside, made a big difference. And then as for the difference between babyface demos and heel demos, it depended a bit on the opponents. They were quite giving to the Twin Towers, working much more from underneath, but against the Brainbusted, they made them cheat at every point to get upon them. So there we go. There's another show here on the network, Tag Teams Back Again, where they talk a lot about Demolition. Marty's got this idea of like Bret Hart's vision of a tag match and Axe's vision of a tag match being different. So that's quite interesting if you want to listen to that. So what I thought we could get into now, Alan, before we finish up on this topic, is what happened to Demolition? Obviously, Axe leaves at some point, doesn't he?
Yeah, I mean, Axe has gone after the Survivor Series 1990. He was in the Perfect Team with Mr. Perfect and the other guys from Demolition, and that was the last we saw of him in the WWF in as Demolition, well, basically at all. So that was him gone. Smash, he hung around till August 91, and then he disappeared for 2 months, and he was repackaged as the Repo Man. But Crush was around till May 91, so that's when Demolition split, was May 1991, and he disappeared back to Portland. So Crush went May 91, Smash hung around just to Smash until August, and then he was gone and he was back as the Repo Man. But Smash and Crush, they teamed, interestingly enough, around this time in Puerto Rico at the 18th anniversary WWC show against the Giant Warrior and TNT, which is quite interesting.
And were they working as Demolition? Or?
Yes, they were.
Wow.
Smash and Crush team. And the other interesting little note I've got here is all things lead to Mr. Fuji. So Axe and Smash are heels managed by Mr. Fuji, okay? Mm-hmm. And the Fuji betrays them and they turn face. Then they turn heel again with Crush and they're the team again with Mr. Fuji. And then Axe leaves, Smash and Crush are still managed by Mr. Fuji. And then Fuji managed Smash and Crush to lose to Tenryu and Katao at WrestleMania 7. And after coming back as a face, Crush turns heel and once again is managed by Mr. Fuji. And then at the Royal Rumble in 94, Tenryu, who wrestled Fuji, managed Crush, teams up with Crush as a hired gun working for Mr. Fuji.
Well, I mean, one thing we should say about Mr. Fuji is that under his kind of second reign of under his tutelage here, he really leads their career down the shitter here, doesn't he? I mean, they go from being the tag champs to jobbing to basically everybody. I think they even have losses to the likes of the Bushwhackers. You know, the Rockers, who up until that point had been a lower team. I guess they were moving up the card a little bit in 1990. Who else?
Yeah, they're losing all over the place. I mean, the pop they got at WrestleMania 6 was huge when they beat the Colossal Connection for the titles. It was only... the only ones bigger on the show that I could see was Hogan and Warrior. So they were, you know, really over still at this point.
And by the end, they're basically fed to all sorts of incoming baby faces. So Crush, for example, loses round the horn to Greg Valentine, as does Smash, the newly turned face Greg Valentine, who of course had his issues with Jimmy Hart, as we've discussed.
Yeah.
Smash is losing to Jimmy Snuka in 1991. He's losing to who else? Texas.
The Bushwhackers, they're both losing to.
The Texas Tornado, kind of post-IC title run. I mean, it's kind of, you know, Virgil.
Yeah.
And Smash even works that as the masked wrestler.
Because he doesn't want to be known as Smash. You know, I mean, if you're losing to Virgil, you don't want to go into your moniker that everyone knows. It's very embarrassing.
So, I mean, it's pretty sad end to Demolition, in a way. Because in the space of a year, they go to being one of the most dominant tag teams. I mean, do they still have the record, Demolition? I want to say this.
Yeah, they've still got the record now, and there's only a few. I mean, as this comes out, they may just be finished by the New Day, but that's well, the New Day we've been pushing on TV, the 600 plus day reign that Demolition had.
So, I mean, yeah, so that's still in the history books now, and in 1991, they're literally like, you know, this dream feud against Legion of Doom, and they're jobbing out in 4 minutes to them, you know, and it's like, I don't know.
It's all Fuji's fault.
Yeah, and I want to say that it's basically Fuji's fault for turning the trajectory of the career. So, that's something we need to do one day, Alan, we've done the decisions of Heenan, the decisions of Fuji. I mean, bloody hell. All throughout his career, he's a disaster.
Oh, he is. I mean, he did have a WWF champion in Yokozuna.
He did. So I guess that's something he has over all of the other managers. All right. Well, I think it's time now to go to WWF Magazine Corner.
Is that what we're calling it now, the Magazine Corner?
Yeah, that's what I've been trying to get it over as. There's a kind of a corner of the cheese platter that we go to right at the end. So...
The new World Wrestling Federation magazine is now on sale. All this and more in the official World Wrestling Federation magazine, on sale this Tuesday at your local newsstand.
Well, this is a bonus question, interestingly enough, and this is why I let this question slide, because normally we have the three short questions, the one long question, and then we started doing the WWF Magazine Corner. But we've got a question here, and it's, Dear Alan and Parv, my favourite wrestler is Terrific Terry Taylor. Could you discuss his views in WWF Magazine, April 1993, page 60, Viewpoints by Terry Taylor? Very precise, that. And that's from Chadley Crisolo in Newark, Connecticut. So Chadley snuck on in here. He knew the gimmick we're doing now, and he probably felt, you know, he's asked too many questions, so he's had to sneak in who his favourite wrestler. So he's gone with Terrific Terry Taylor, Parv, in 93. I mean, Terrific Terry Taylor in 1993 was doing diddly squat. He was low on the card, wasn't he, Parv? I mean, this is where it's discussed in this. He he took over as the host of Wrestling Spotlight TV. I'm just going to read this article quickly, Parv. Okay. This is the terrific Terry Taylor viewpoint, and we've got a great shot of him here, haven't we, on page 60 of the WWF magazine.
And that was one of the things that was making me laugh so much, is that the idea that this guy is anybody's favorite wrestler is really funny, because I mean, he epitomizes 1993 in virtually every way. Carry on.
Okay, well, ever since yours truly, Terrific Terry Taylor, took over as host of the Wrestling Spotlight TV show, the ratings have gone through the roof. Not that it should come as any surprise to anyone. Just look at me. I'm terrific from head to toe. I'm a terrific broadcaster and a terrific athlete. My qualifications, so I hear, have ruffled the feathers of some people. I like that there, Parv. You know, that ruffled the feathers.
Ruffled the feathers, yeah. Very nice. Yep.
Take a guy like Gorilla Monsoon, for instance. He calls himself the host of Wrestling Challenge. Hang on a minute. He is the host of Wrestling Challenge. I mean, come on, Terrific Terry Taylor. Gorilla, give me a break. Everyone knows that Bobby the Brain Heenan is the real host of the program. In fact, if it weren't for the Brain, Gorilla Monsoon would definitely have found himself out of a job. Bobby Heenan is insightful. He's brilliant. He's a broadcast journalist. I can't say good enough things about the man. He's a man every youngster and adult can look up to and respect. Unlike Vince McMahon and Randy Savage, they're another pair of so-called television hosts. They're seen on Superstars every week, and Randy Savage is on Monday Night Raw every Monday on the USA Network. They may know what they're talking about, but they are far from terrific. They cannot hold a candle to my brilliant broadcast abilities, and I get pretty annoyed when they double-team the King on Superstars. I mean, the King knows more about the Superstars in the World Wrestling Federation than Vince McMahon or Randy Savage will ever know. Jerry's the King of Wrestling, and that should tell them all that you reject something. So he goes on about, you know, how he's terrific and how he's the host on Wrestling Spotlight, why you should come and see him in live and in Technicolor when he competes in a town near you. But yeah, he's basically just saying terrific over and over again and put himself over here, and that's about it on this part. He doesn't kind of get in any feuds as such. He just kind of slags off the face announcers.
Well, I mean, my major observation here is that older Terrific Terry Taylor's got a very short memory, hasn't he? I mean, last time he was in the WWF, he was had a lot of issues with the brilliant, insightful Bobby Heenan. What happened to all that? I mean,
well, swept under the carpet, so to speak. He's back as the terrific one now. I mean, he was in 93. He was in the Royal Rumble in 93. I do remember that. And he came out with the red... I think he had red trunks on, and I don't know if that was a callback to the Rooster gimmick or not. But he didn't really do much. He was on Raw around this time, and... I don't know, his career just faded out, didn't it, Parv? I mean, he did go back to WCW in 94. I think he had a short run. I think he was on Super Brawl in 94, if memory serves. But he didn't really do much after this, did he?
No, I mean, he's another guy who was always somewhat involved with the backstage politics and the office. And I mean, I know, I mean, famously, Terry Taylor got on the bad side of Dusty, and then he got on the bad side of Vince. So... you know, in the late 80s, if you're on the bad side of both Dusty and Vince, what are you going to do?
Yeah, when the territories are dying, there's nowhere else to go. I mean, he was always a good worker in the 80s, in Mid-South especially, wasn't he? I mean, that's where I enjoy him the most.
So it's just occurred to me that he went from basically being a knockoff Ted DiBiase as the tailor-made man to being a knockoff Mr. Perfect as the terrific Terry Taylor.
Yeah. Didn't have much luck in these kind of gimmicks later on in his run. But, I mean, he was around. He's still around to this day back in WWE NXT as a producer. So he's still got a role in wrestling, even though he wasn't liked by many people. So they must like him a little bit.
Yeah, he's almost like the kind of prototype. Who was that guy? Johnny Ace, you know, the... John Rod, like one of those guys.
Artist, yeah.
One of those guys who didn't have, like, the best wrestling career, but has somehow managed to kind of worm his way to always be in the business, you know?
Yeah.
So, anyway, Terrific.
Well, thank you very much, Chadley, for the question. Or maybe I shouldn't be thanking you. I should be saying stick with just one wrestler, Chadley. I mean, I don't know. Terry Taylor was a good worker, but in 93, how could he possibly be your favourite wrestler? Come on.
All right. Well, if people want to write in more questions to the sack, I already mentioned at the start that they should get in touch with us on Twitter, but specifically through the mechanism of replying to that message I put out so that we can get a hold of it.
Yeah, that's probably the best way. But you can follow us on Twitter as well. I'm at Alan_Cheapshot. And yourself, Parv, what's your handle?
I'm at Jerry Von K.
I mean, handle, I'm going back to, I'm speaking CB radios there. I'm not too sure with Twitter. But yeah, you can check us out on there. But you can also join the discussion over at the Pro Wrestling Only message boards, which is prowrestlingonly.com, in the publication section. We've got a thread going on there as well, haven't we?
With the way you're talking, Alan, you need to go to www.facebook.com. on the information superhighway. Yeah. there is if you type in Pro Wrestling Only on there, you'll also see the Facebook group. And as you heard, that's another way that you can write in. As
a Facebook group and bulletin boards, I'd like to call them.
Bulletin boards, wow. Do you remember the AOL chats? I was on them for a while.
I remember the AOL chats in, would have been the mid-90s. You could have the WF chats. And we got the free discs a lot, didn't we, in the UK?
Yeah. Oh, well, the 90s. All right, well, yes, join us next time for Letters from Kayfabe.
Adios.
In addition to which, as we mentioned before, Virgil in the rematch against Bastion Booger, standing by with comments, Bastion Booger. Virgil, you punk! I came here to the World Wrestling Federation to make my mark.
Virgil, are you feeling pretty good about yourself?
When we meet right here again next week, you may not survive.
That should be some matchup. Virgil squaring off against Bastion Booger right here next week.
Well, I'll tell you this. I pick Booger to win.